I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're going to be talking with Andrew Hodges, who is the author of the definitive biography of Alan Turing. Andrew teaches mathematics at Oxford University. His book is Alan Turing, The Enigma, and it is the book that inspired the film The Imitation Game. He wrote it in 1983. It has been updated since then, and of course, we know more about Turing since 1983. He played a central role in world history. And it's interesting that President Obama signaled him out, Newton, Darwin, and Alan Turing, as British contributors to science who were not to be surpassed. He said that in 2011, and our guest says that his choice signaled that public recognition of Turing had attained a level very much higher than in 1983 when his book first appeared. There, of course, are reasons for that, mostly the very, very sensitive work that he was doing. He writes that it was his individual mind, freedom of mind, including his sexuality, that mattered. And it is striking how leading scientific intellects were recruited to meet this existential threat. And it wasn't that the case that Britain faced in 1939. You probably know the story of Turing. He's considered to be the inventor of the computer, breaking the Enigma, the Nazi code, and then having to keep silent about that, and not letting the Germans know that the code had been broken, which required, you know, overlooking some horrors that took place just so that they wouldn't be aware that the code had been broken. His trial for homosexuality, his treatment and what it did to him, his suicide, it all makes for a very, very compelling story. And, you know, the guy was pretty shy. He didn't write a lot of papers because he was doing this secret work and didn't want a whole lot of public attention. And so we forgot about him for all these years. It was our loss, but now our gain. So that's what we talk about this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Dr. Andrew Hodges. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. Dr. Andrew Hodges, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, our pleasure. You know, I found it, so I was just thinking about this afternoon. You write early in the book, in the introduction to the book, that that Alan Turing was very upset by the movie Snow White, which he saw when he was 4 or 5 years old. He was very upset about the poisoned apple. And then I had it in my mind, oh my goodness, there was a cyanide-laced apple that he ate to commit suicide. Isn't that bizarre that he had that thought in his mind when he was 4 or 5 years old, and that's the way that he died?
No, that's not quite the story.
It's
actually
not the story?
No. Well, if you think of the film, the Snow White film came out in 1938 in the UK anyway. He was 37, I think, in the US, and Alan Turing was 26 then. So I think you've got the slightly wrong picture.
Well, what was the Snow White story then?
But it's true that he saw it, and it's true that it made an impression on him. And I think the reason was, if you're interested, he had already, in a period of some depression in 1937, thought about means of suicide and had settled on a plan. This is my interpretation, a plan which could be carried out, but could be read by other people if they wanted as an accident incurred through a dangerous chemistry experiment, and indeed involved the poisoned apple. And I think when he saw the famous Disney film, he was very struck by the fact that this icon appeared in the film and remarked on it to others later. I think that's what you're referring to.
It is amazing that your book was written quite some years ago now, that here was this man who was such a brilliant mathematician, one of the most remarkable Englishmen of the century, and because of the work that he did and because of maybe his homosexuality as well, we just didn't know very much about this genius for such a long period of time. When did you first decide, I really want to devote this very comprehensive, very long book to his life?
Yes, that's a good point. Well, there's been a whole process here, and I think in recent years, the two most important things have been, first of all, that the computer means so much more to everyone now than it did even in the 1980s, because it's a personal thing. As people use their laptops, their, you know, whatever, their, and their cell phones, which are also just computers. And a computer is a social thing now. It does everything for you, and you've got this very direct sense of what the nature of digital computation is about. And that, of course, wasn't accessible in the 1980s. So that's one thing. People are interested in that and interested in who really had the ideas that lay behind it. And the other thing, of course, is this is a big change, certainly in the UK where I'm speaking from, but I think in other parts of the world as well, in seeing that his fate as a gay man wasn't just to be thought of as an individual tragedy, which is how it was thought of before, but as something which really speaks to a story about human rights and about central values in a way that now people would identify much more with and see as something that's really telling a very sharp story about the history of the 20th century after doing so much for a war which was supposed to be about freedom. And he suffered very considerably for a desire for that mm-hmm. kind of freedom. And I think that's made a big difference, I think. But now, coming back to, I should turn to your question about when I got going on it, which was in the mid-70s, he wasn't so well known then. And one reason was that the material about his work during the Second World War had only just emerged in the mid-1970s. And indeed, the documents didn't really emerge until the mid-1990s. So that was sort of fresh thing, and no one really knew at that point how to put it together with the scientific story, with his professional life as a great mathematician, how peace and war, how science and technology had all fitted together. So then it was quite unknown, and that was very exciting, tackling that whole thing.
Oh, I imagine it was. So did he, I can't even conceive how he could do this, if he did this, conceive of the idea of artificial intelligence before he could think about the possibility of a physical thing, a computer, that would have artificial intelligence. Can you have an idea in your mind and not think about the physical thing that would make it possible?
Well, I think that's very well put. And you see, that really is essentially what mathematicians do. That is what mathematical sciences are like. It's thinking about the ideas before you can have things that you can see and touch and work and do things for you. That's exactly where the prophetic role of mathematics comes in. It's very abstract and therefore a bit hard to describe to people. But that was where he fitted into science. It was in that visionary quality. So very specifically, in the mid-1930s, he came up with this theoretical idea of a universal machine and the universality of the computer. It is that idea which he came up with, a single machine which can play out any program that you write for it. That was his idea, and he was inspired to do that partly through technical things in mathematics, which I won't go into, but also partly by a question about what is the mind? What can the mind do? How is the mind embodied in the brain? And those questions, which he brought into his discussion of what computation is all about, those things went right through his life and led him on to be a real pioneer of thinking about artificial intelligence. Though his use of, well, he didn't actually use those words, he called it intelligent machinery, which really meant the same thing. Mm-hmm. And he wrote famous papers on that, the most famous one in 1950.
And did some of that, you write about the death of his dear friend, the young man he loved when he was 18 years old, who passed away when he was 18 years old, and Turing went into this very long thought process of mind and physicality, and whether one can exist beyond the death of another?
Yes, he did. He had a very distinctive first love experience when he was when he was 17, unrequited, I may say. I mean, it's not only within his mind, but it was very, very clear, and must have made a huge impression on him, both emotionally, but also, as you've indicated, because he wasn't someone who could put life into completely separate compartments. And so his experience of this feeling about this other young man certainly flowed into his intellectual life and thinking about what the nature of the mind was, what it was that had gone, what had been lost, how could it exist and then go. And he wrote very movingly to the dead boy's mother in the letter, which I think you're quoting from there. And that's our best clue, really, to his very individual thinking when he was 19, 20, that forms the infrastructure, the underlying pattern of thought that went into his investigations later in the 1930s, which led to the idea of the computer.
Hmm. So they were linked in some ways, isn't that phenomenal?
They were linked, yeah. Not because one thing directly implies the other, but because it set in motion a whole way of individual thinking about the mind and what you mean by what the mind is doing, what thinking is, and so forth. And that led him to a very, very unusual point of view on mathematics, which other mathematicians wouldn't have done. It wasn't the normal thing to do. It was absolutely his thing.
Mm-hmm. Was he terribly political? You talk about his being at Princeton and going back to England, where many people would have stayed in America, which was thought to be a little bit safer than being back in England at the late 1930s. Did he understand the threat of Nazism? Did he write about it? Did he think about it? Is that why he went back to fight it?
Yes, that's an interesting point. His motivation for getting involved in the code and cipher work during the Second World War, it certainly began in 1936, well before the war started, and it flowed out of his interest in the computing world. He started thinking about what is the most general kind of code or cipher, and said he'd invented some new types of cipher, which would be very interesting and useful, right back in that early period. And he went further than that and started engineering some machines to implement them, which was a very unusual step to make while at Princeton, while a graduate student, with a friend of his who was a physics graduate student. They had discussions, and those discussions certainly were in the context of looming war with Germany. That was the way he talked about the purpose of the work he was doing. I think most people knew him would say, well, it wasn't that, you know, the fascination of the technical side and the creative side of inventing new things and the challenge of deciphering would have been really the thing that grabbed him most. But there's no question that there was a real understanding of the world situation. And it is indeed very important, as you've indicated, that in summer of 1938, he made a very definite decision and went back to England while he could have stayed as what we'd now call a postdoc position in the United States, a prestigious, good career position. He didn't take that up. He went back to a very uncertain position in England and indeed essentially volunteered himself for the service in the war in this field of then very unknown field of cryptology.
Mm-hmm. You're right, and I don't understand math very well, so amplify this for me, that he was going to meet the existential threat Britain faced in 1939. The struggle with Nazi Germany called not just for scientific knowledge, but the cutting edge of abstract thought. And so Turing's quiet, logical preparations in 36 through 38 for the War of Codes and Ciphers made him the most effective anti-fascist among his many anti-fascist contemporaries. I like the way you wrote that. What was the cutting edge of abstract thought that you read about?
Well, I'm thinking of this, because he needed this concept of what it is that you can do mechanically, what the scope of machinery could be, how you would turn a thought process, a guessing type of process or repetitive search type of thing you do on pencil and paper, how you could turn that into the machinery of a kind which had never been built before. And that was where it was. And incidentally, I think I use that expression about the abstract thought because there's a wonderful, very telling parallel to that, and that's, of course, in the field of quantum physics, Well, exactly the same moment, the same sort of people were having to turn their minds from the pure abstract scientific development of understanding of the atom to the crisis that was made clear in 1938 when it was clear that uranium fission was possible and that the race was on already. He was very close to the kind of people who went into that. In fact, his friend Maurice Price, who he knew at Princeton, was one of just such people. And so there's a strong parallel with the people who went into the atomic bomb project, and which was, you know, essentially a parallel, very large project developing more and more strongly towards the as the war went on, and what Alan Turing did. So that's one reason behind my remark there. And he was the leader in doing this. He was the first scientific figure to come into the British code-breaking establishment, which was by that time in 1938, knew it had to have some new things and indeed advertised for a mathematician very shortly after he got in touch and indeed acquired many mathematical people immediately the war started. But he was the first to do that. He was a leader of the scientific revolution and made a very, very great impact very quickly at the beginning of the Second World War.
And we probably would have known a lot more about him prior to your book, and if he had been able to be public about what it was that he was doing, but he couldn't be public then, and then nobody knew for all those years because it was all under wraps, right?
Well, it wasn't just him, of course. There were thousands of people, and it wasn't just the United Kingdom. It was the United States was equally involved by the after the United States came into the war in 1941. It was very closely, as far as the Atlantic War was concerned, it was enmeshed completely with the UK effort. And exactly the same considerations applied to the many people who worked in the US as well. It was not disclosed from either side of the Atlantic until the people started leaking it in the mid-1970s. And he was just one of thousands of people, though, of course, more distinctive in that he had been, as I said, you know, the first in and one of the most creative people who really set the tone for everything that was done. And it's certainly true, if you're looking at his individual trajectory, it didn't help him that he couldn't say after the war what he'd done, what his nature of his experience was. In particular, in 1945, when he wanted to put forward a very detailed design for a first electronic computer, it came as if he was just a Cambridge theorist, a mathematician, who didn't really have any basis for what he was talking about, and he couldn't have said, actually, he had designed and seen through and, you know, got to work in detail in day-to-day work these very advanced machines that were breaking the Enigma very effectively. I mean, he couldn't point to the kind of experience that he had, and that certainly couldn't have been to his advantage.
Exactly.
In that period afterwards.
Tell me about the restrictions of not, and the movie makes this a big part of the movie too, so I'm wondering what you know about this and what he said about it, if anything. This whole idea of having broken the code but not letting the Germans know that you had broken the code because it could result in disaster, but you had to live through witnessing, you know, bombings that took place because you didn't want them to know. I can't imagine being in that position. That must have been horrible.
Well, he wasn't anything directly to do with the use of the material. That wasn't his business. He would have known a great deal about some of the operations that were needed to capture material. I mean, there were important developments in 1940 and 41, when important captures were made from German submarines of bits of information that were needed to enhance and make progress with the code breaking, so he would have known about those. But the use of the code material that arose from breaking the Enigma ciphers, that wasn't his business at all. I mean, that was done by military people.
But he must have seen.
But he was aware. It was very spectacular when they could get actual raw messages out, and they were saying things like, going to attack this convoy and this kind of thing. That was very exciting to see this material coming out. But it had to be explained to the codebreakers that you couldn't just use it right away. You had to pool the information and use it as effectively as possible, all cross-referenced, and very sparingly used, and often with reconnaissance missions organized so as to give a cover for the use of the information and so forth. And that, but that wasn't his business. I mean, that wasn't what he did.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls for our guests, and we'll take them momentarily. Andrew Hodges is with us. He's the author of Alan Turing, The Enigma. It is the book that inspired the film The Imitation Game. And here's how you reach us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Dr. Hodges teaches mathematics at Oxford University, and it is a very, very thorough look at what was, by many accounts, one of the most remarkable people in England of the entire century, and his incredible story. So we'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Andrew Hodges is here this hour, and we're talking about the life of Alan Turing. Feel free to join the conversation if you would like. We have some Facebook messages we'll get to, and we invite you to call in if you would like at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Here's an interesting comment on Facebook, Dr. Hodges. Pam writes this: the story of Alan Turing embodies two kinds of bravery, living with being gay in that time in Great Britain, and the courage of original thought. The first gets at least some discussion. The second is entirely unrecognized.
Well, I think he's always been... that's a nice parallel to draw, and I think they're very close in his mind. He acted as a unity, in a sense. He had a very strong personality, both witty and but also sharp and engaging, but also characteristically truthful. I mean, that was the thing. And of course, it made it difficult to be truthful when he was gay in a hostile environment. But the commitment to truthfulness and the scientific attitude was something that shone through, and that struck everyone who knew him. You know, fascination with ideas and facts and principles and getting things right. So that was, I think, recognized, and I think that was something that was quite strongly remarked about him, that he had this unstoppable kind of zeal for new ideas and getting things, seeing things the right way and seeing them through. So he was, it was not unknown. He wasn't a hidden talent in that way. He made a strong impression on those who knew him. And indeed, he also was beginning towards the end of his life to be quite a public communicator of science. He was on the radio in 1951. He was not an unknown figure. He was a fellow of the Royal Society. He wrote a very nice popular article about his work towards the end of his life. And indeed, his famous paper about artificial intelligence, which is full of it's full of jokes, if you like. It's full of things which connect with ordinary people's experience. It's something I think would have made him if he'd lived into the 60s, he would have been a great sort of guru of science, and someone who talks about computing and computers, and indeed many other scientific topics in a very interesting way. So, not, you know, I mean, he's a many-faceted person.
Yes, and so young when he died, it's amazing somebody could be that brilliant and do all that he did at such a young age. So let's talk about his arrest. When he was arrested, why in the world he was tried? It's almost difficult, as we are about to have marriage equality in this country deigned so by the Supreme Court, we're expecting in the next couple months. It's almost hard to read about what life was like for people who are homosexual during his time period. But it's hard to understand too how somebody who has made such a contribution, you know, to ending a war, to inventing computers, etc., can be tried for being a homosexual.
Well, of course, you summed it up. Well, that is a very natural reaction to what happens and as it's seen from the present day. But at the time, what happened was extremely typical of what happened to gay men in that period. And he was just, the events which led to his arrest were very ordinary, if you like, in the context of the Manchester life where he was in. And hundreds of other gay men were caught in a very similar way, with something going a bit wrong and therefore coming to the notice of the police. And that was what happened. Everyone accepted him. That was arrest and trial, and usually complete social disgrace followed. That wasn't something that many people challenged at all. So he was very unusual in his reaction, which was that the law was ridiculous and so forth, and which didn't do him any good, I think. Of course, the other thing you've mentioned that is particularly striking when it happened to him, who made a big contribution, indeed was a big figure in science. Well, of course, his contribution wasn't known to anyone involved in it, certainly not the police or anyone at the local level. The fact that he was a distinguished scientist was certainly said as a character statement about him in the trial. I don't think it actually made any difference. At that point, under the Conservative government, which came in 1951, there was a definite sort of sense of a crackdown and of having a purge and putting the things right after they got out of hand during the Second World War, and things had to be put right again. And there was increased number of prosecutions, and indeed that is a striking facet of the period, that there was much more publicity given to, not so much his trial, which hardly got any publicity at all, but there's another famous cases of the 1952 period, and it was actually that and the fact that it got into the newspapers the first time, rather than being treated as a dirty secret that no one could possibly talk about. It was that which led to the beginning of the law reform process, because in 1954, the UK government set up a royal commission to look at the whole question, and its recommendations eventually, it's really about 50 years later.
Right, a long time later.
And basically, it's the same process took place in the United States and in other European countries. I mean, it wasn't that the United Kingdom was alone in this. Every country had its own way of doing these things, but essentially this is a big global change we're talking about. It's not a specifically British thing.
Right. And it took so long. I mean, we're just looking in the last few years, really, for there to be a pardon, right?
Well, it's not quite clear. I mean, that's... these things are... I'm not sure what the attitude to take for the pardon. It doesn't mean anything when he's already dead for 50 years anyway.
Right.
It's a symbolic thing, isn't it? So it's a little bit confused in what it's saying. A big point has been made by myself and many other people too, is that of course there's no good principle involved in this legal pardon for an individual. The principle should be it's the same for everyone. The law, everyone's equal under the law. And the law applies to everyone, mm-hmm. thousands and thousands of other people, some of whom, would have been even more unfairly treated than him. So I'm not entirely with that, but of course it has highlighted a sense, which I referred to at the beginning of this, that it's not just an individual story that now people react to, but a great sense that a human right, as people would see it now, had been completely trodden over in that period. I think that's really what comes across to me.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Is there any question in your mind about whether or not he committed suicide, or is there anything at all to... Some people have said that it was an accidental mixture of chemicals or whatever that may have harmed him, some experiment gone awry. What do you think?
Well, he devised a scheme which could allow people to think that. I mean, he died of cyanide poisoning,
mm-hmm.
and you can look at the coroner's report on the web. It's all available, and it was a severe ingestion of cyanide in his stomach that he died from. So it wasn't anything sort of vague about it at all. It was very definite poisoning. And he had indeed devised, he was indeed doing a home chemistry experiment which used cyanide for doing gold plating, which he'd done. But I've no doubt at all that he devised it as something which allowed people, in particular his mother, to believe that it was an accident. There are a number of features. I mean, he'd made his will very shortly before that, and a very distinctive will, too, not just a formal thing, just a very, very definite, decisive choice of what to do. That's just one example. And also, he'd spoken of the Apple icon.
Yes.
He had reflected on how it was an icon of life and death. And its a strange connection with the iconography of the Disney film. So it formed a practical purpose because his mother believed he'd got the cyanide on his fingers. I mean, she'd always nagged him about doing chemistry experiments when he was a little boy, you know, be careful, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so it was like, I told you so, something was going to go awfully wrong, and it did. And so it all fitted into that, so it had a practical purpose. But on the other hand, it also, I think, did have this symbolic value. It's the innocence and loss of innocence. And in my view, he may well have been aware that his really decisive moment was in 1938, when he left the pure and innocent world of mathematics for its own sake and gave himself to worldly affairs in the code-breaking department. And that was a major step. That was a very distinctive moral thing to do, which he would have certainly knew it was a very decisive thing to do. And after that, you couldn't be rid of it again. I mean, he was bound up with government and with government secrecy. And his situation in after 1952, as a gay man who was unrepentant and awkward and insisted on going around Europe on his holidays in 1952 and 1953, would have been an extremely difficult and threatening figure for the government establishment of that time, or indeed of any time, indeed of now. I mean, it would still be a very awkward figure now, that he was not bound by a convention, and he held these enormous secrets. I mean, equivalent to the atomic secrets. They were the secrets of how Anglo-American cryptography worked. And there he was, all over the place, in Norway and Greece and France, and goodness knows who he would have met and so forth. I think he was in a very, 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 very extreme position. And I think it may well have been made very clear to him that this couldn't go on, that this was not possible for him to behave in this way. And my view is that probably was the last straw.
We are welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about Alan Turing this hour of the program with the author of the definitive biography. The movie is based on this book. Alan Turing, the Enigma. Andrew Hodges, mathematician at Oxford, is with us, and we go to William in Middleton. Thanks for waiting, William. Hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm always amazed by how, at the same time in the 20s and 30s, the brilliant minds, the mathematicians, scientists, were in America, England, and Germany. They were all equivalent. They were all racing to create an atomic bomb. Now, my question is, they seem to be equivalent also in a secret code. Is it not true that some submarine of the Germans had been gotten hold of the code, the secret code had been gotten out of that submarine, and Turing had a very major role in playing and breaking that German code? Is that not true, please?
All right, so it's more complicated than that. Most of the information about the Enigma was known to the British and French at the outset of the Second World War, and that was primarily because they had a fantastic gift of information from Poland. The Polish analysts were miles ahead, and they'd got information about the details of the Enigma by a mixture of spying and algebra, because they were well ahead scientifically and mathematically. They'd done a wonderful thing and also had very creative ideas about how to do code breaking with it, which they passed on. However, that wasn't the whole story, and in particular, the German naval codes and the submarine codes are more complicated and use a sort of super encipherment, a sort of extra password system, which you had to hack into as well. And hacking into that required getting into capturing some information, paper, book information, carried on the submarines. And that was necessary more than once in 1941-42. And those captures were important. But after they'd got that information, the British, and indeed the United States analysts who worked with the British, were able to keep on top of the situation until the end of the war without a succession of captures. But you're right in thinking naval operations did come into it, but they weren't the entire key by any means. The whole scientific analysis and methods were laid down well before, and the information couldn't have been exploited without that big industrial-sized apparatus being developed at Bletchley Park in England.
And there's a museum now. Bletchley Park has a museum. What's that like? Is it worth
watching? Oh, yes, I'm very pleased to mention the name of Bletchley Park and the marvelous museum that's now there, and which is now a world-class operation, and full of not only the exhibits which you see, but very full records and documents, archivists who are giving full justice to all the material as well. So that's a very, if anyone's going to England, that's a very worthwhile visit to make.
I'm sure it is. Thank you very much, William, for calling. Our number is 800-486-8655. Let's go back to his mother for a while, because you write about the lack of information considering his life. He didn't publish because he couldn't publish, and not too many people were writing about him. But his mother did. His mother wrote a slim volume about her son. What did she say about him?
Yes, it's a very extraordinary thing. She was in her 70s when he died. And I think that part of the motivation was precisely that she wanted to counter the suicide verdict and put her own view forward, which she had been convinced of, I think, by his way of doing it, that it had been an accident. So she wanted to... So, I mean, that's one reason, I think, one motivation. The other, I think, was very... it was actually, curiously, that she actually got the idea which other people didn't see so clearly, but where she was absolutely right, was that he really had simply had the idea of the computer. And that's something which more clever and sophisticated people in the mathematical and technical world didn't actually quite get. He had the idea of it before the war, and then he wanted to turn it into a practical electronic design and make it work in a completely modern way after the war. And actually, she saw that rather clearly and put that forward in her book. So that's good for her, that she definitely got that on the record.
It is, good for her. What about the Internet? Did he imagine that?
No one could have done that. But he did say things that showed the whole scope of his vision. For instance, describing the very first computer design that he developed, he remarked on how it could be used by remote telephone operation, which is the beginning of communication between computers and using remote terminals that now, of course, we take for granted, but wasn't so obvious then, when you would have thought of the machine as a thing which just sat in a room and that's it, you see?
Yes.
So he did have that extra vision, which came, of course, from his great experience in the Second World War, when they'd done remote control operations of this kind. For instance, real-time data sharing between the United States and the UK in the latter part of the war. He was absolutely au fait with the most up-to-date ways of thinking about communication.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the life of Alan Turing with the man who has written the definitive biography of him. Andrew Hodges is our guest, mathematician at Oxford, author of Alan Turing, The Enigma. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we'll be back with your phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network. And we go back to phone calls for Dr. Hodges. Bob in Manitowish Waters is next. Hi, Bob.
Yes, hi there. I'm enjoying your program. I wanted to ask if there was anyone of sufficiently high rank or political authority who might have stepped in and set the charges against Turing aside before they went to trial and thus freed him up to continue his scientific research.
Right, that's an interesting question. It's that one thing that's certainly missing in all this is the internal government reports which must have circulated in 1952, detailing what had happened, questioning what to do about it, and also dealing with the question of Alan Turing's security status, which would have been a very, very delicate question at that time. And the answer seems to be no, that it actually would have been a bit difficult to interfere with the local administration of justice and to pull a case. I suppose it could have been done, but it would have been very awkward when the thing was already being dealt with by the local police, and it's conceivable, but they didn't anyway. What they did do was that the effective head of the code-breaking establishment, GCHQ, acted as character witness, but his name was kept out of the newspapers, which suggests that they were told not to, that it couldn't be referred to. And he was a character witness and clearly indicated that this was someone special. However, the effect of that was not that he got off the charge at all. The effect of that was that the prison was, which otherwise would have been certainly would have been very possible. He didn't have to go to prison, and instead was offered this chemical treatment called organotherapy, which is essentially chemical castration. And that was offered as what was at that time thought of as the liberal, modern, scientific alternative. And it was not thought of as an extra cruel punishment. And that was he was obliged to take. Otherwise, he would have gone to prison and lost his position and everything. So that was, I think, the effect of what a government intervention there was. But I think your question still hints at a larger question, really, is what on earth went on within secret government circles at that period. I would like to know very much, and I'd like to know what reports were made on his activities thereafter, in particular his very defiant foreign travel within Europe, which was explicitly done to get away from the English law and therefore to assert his individuality and his sexual life in a way that the law in England couldn't touch, which could not have gone down very well, to say the least.
Are those reports accessible? Are they available? Have they been destroyed?
No. I mean, they're like all things. They're not. There's no right to have them at all, and indeed, we don't know what happened.
Right. I'm just wondering. He evidently wasn't a very good student, from what you've written about him. How does anybody get to be that much of a genius, that smart, that visionary? Where does it come from?
Well, it didn't come from his family, except it, in as much as his mother's family has an engineering base. It wasn't there was a vaguely scientific side to it. So it didn't come from being pushed into this, far from it, and it didn't come from any obvious point at all. He just developed a very natural sense of wonder and interest in the natural world. I'd say in science before mathematics, and then he went into mathematics more, I think probably influenced by Einstein's relativity, which is the first thing he really studied that was serious mathematically. But no, you can't account for it, and I don't think you can explain these things. That's how it happened. He wasn't very well. I mean, it was very, very, very old-fashioned kind of education, which would have put Latin and things at the top, and science didn't come terribly high. He largely ignored all the things he was supposed to do, and did his own thing.
Right.
But that characteristic did run through his life. He was like that as a boy, and he did continue with that sense of doing things that no one else would quite have thought of doing. And that indeed was the key to the code breaking
right.
and the computer as well as everything else. He struck people always. One thing that struck people always, he had a very young manner. Both appearance and manner, boyish, if you like. And so he had this sort of freshness and uncultivated approach. He always thought to be very scruffy as well. That was the thing that was always held against him. But there, you see, he was really just ahead of his time. He was just like the T-shirt and jeans scientist of the future, out of his time.
And running. We haven't even talked about running. He started that whole craze. I know.
But he did become a champion amateur athlete in the post-war British world. And he was near Olympic, near Olympic standard, in fact. Nearly he was in the Olympics of 1948. And very distinctive for that. How on earth he found the time for training.
Exactly.
It beats me.
Yeah, I know. I know you don't want to comment too much on the movie, so you can respond to this email or not, but I wanted to read it. Paul sends this email. The Imitation Game has received significant criticism for, one, not accurately portraying events such as the development of the computer, but especially for significantly and negatively varying from Turing's actual personality. He was not the isolated misfit of the movie's characterization. I've heard estimates that the work shortened the war by at least a year, and given the prototypes of newer German technology, there may have been this may have been decisive in the overall outcome. Do you want to respond to any of that?
Well, there's two quite separate things in there, aren't there, about the personality and then the question of what the overall strategic effect was on the war. Well, I can also just encourage people, they can read my book, they can see it's not just what I say, but the one reason my book is long is that it includes an awful lot of quotations, so you can see for yourself the things that he said and wrote and so forth. I think that's the most important thing. So I'd invite people to do that, or they can look at my website just for a taster as well. So that's, I think, my invitation is for people to see for themselves. And indeed, all his papers and letters are available on the web as well. So there's masses of opportunity for exploring this directly rather than taking it from a movie version. So that's one thing I'd say there. Oh, one thing I'll just throw in is that the very word imitation game, that is Turing's own words, and it's his description of part of his way of thinking about it, artificial intelligence. It's comparing human and mechanical operations in a sort of game, and the whole point is it's a joke, and it involves people, and it involves ordinary people making common sense decisions about what's going on, and it involves asking whether the machine can understand a joke. I mean, it's full of life, and it's full of communication and humor, and it's oddball, if you like, but it's also very, very famous and much cited by all people, not just philosophers and artificial intelligence people, but lots of cultural people as well, because it has this purchase on the way people think and communicate. So that was what he was like, and the word imitation game is itself a joke, his joke, and part of a joke at culture and the way that we think. So that may not be quite the same as the as certain other people's picture, and that's what I'd like to point you to.
All right.
Do you want me to respond on the questions about...
Sure. Go ahead.
On the question of shortening the war, it's very hard to say these things. It was just enormously valuable, obviously, to have something which was like a daily newspaper full of nothing but first-hand German signals.
I imagine.
Effectively what happened. Now, to say what would have happened without it, you'd have to know what kind of aerial reconnaissance, you know, what other measures could have been adopted, and it's very hard to say. But the two-year statement came from a historian, Professor Harry Hinsley, who wrote the official government history of the intelligence effort. He made such a statement. But even that I find very, it's a very problematic one, because if the war had gone on any longer than it did, then the atomic warfare would have started in Europe rather than in Japan. And the whole outcome would have been different. The whole question of the place of the Soviet Union would have been... I mean, everything would have been different. Biological warfare would have been used. I mean, it's just too awful to think about.
Right, yeah.
It's not just the question of going on longer. So I think that's slightly the wrong perspective.
And we are out of time. And I thank you so much. What a fascinating book and conversation. Thank you, Dr. Hodges.
Thank you very much.
Our guest this hour, Dr. Andrew Hodges, and the book is Alan Turing, The Enigma. It is the book that inspired the film The Imitation Game. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster and KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee. Stay with us for great conversations ahead. Tomorrow during this hour, we'll be talking about Five Presidents, which KP and I will see tonight. It's premiering at the Milwaukee Rep. Rick Cleveland will join us, whose credentials include House of Cards and West Wing. Should be a great conversation.